This country is at war with Germany.
Hallo zusammen und damit herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg. Mein Name ist Raffaella Höfner. In jeder Folge spreche ich mit ehemaligen Soldaten, mit US-Veteranen, mit Überlebenden und Opfern des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Hört aus erster Hand die Erlebnisse, die Schrecken und Wunder, die meine Gäste selbst erlebt haben. Hier geht es um den Tatort Zweiter Weltkrieg. Ein Podcast gegen das Vergessen und für den Frieden. November 1944. Brummern. Ein kleiner Ort vor Gallenkirchen am Westwall. Ich liege in Deckung hinter einem Damm und warte auf das Kommando zum Angriff. Die Artillerie bringt den Boden zum Beben. Stunde um Stunde, Minute um Minute kämpfen wir gegen die Deutschen um jeden Meter Land. Wir, das sind die Soldaten des 84. Infanterieregiments der US-amerikanischen Truppen. Die Deutschen verteidigen die Stadt verbittert. Hier gibt es Bunker, Panzersperren und Wassergräben. Unsere Aufgabe klingt einfach. Gallenkirchen um jeden Preis einnehmen. Hier ist die Grenze zwischen den Frontabschnitten. Eine Schlüsselstelle, die wir unbedingt brauchen. Es regnet. In den letzten 2 Wochen hat es jeden verdammten Tag wie aus Kübeln gegossen. Der Herbst hat die Blätter von den Bäumen gepustet. Die Baumkronen sind zerfetzt von den Explosionen der Granaten. Der Regen hat die Landschaft in ein Morastmeer verwandelt. Wann kommen endlich die frischen Männer, von denen der Sir schon geredet hat? Unsere Unterstützung, die wir so sehr brauchen. 10 Wochen schwerer Kämpfe liegen hinter uns, seit wir in der Normandie gelandet sind. Innerhalb von ein paar Wochen haben wir den Durchbruch durch Frankreich, Belgien und Holland geschafft. Jetzt stehen wir an der Eingangstür zu Deutschland. Ich fahre mit der Hand über das raue Abzeichen meiner Gruppe. Eine rote Axt auf einem kreisrunden weißen Hintergrund. Das Zeichen der Railsplitters. Mein bester Freund, der neben mir kauert, stöhnt leise auf. Wir warten auf die Panzer, die schon längst hätten eintreffen sollen. Shit. Da hinten stecken die Panzer im Schlamm fest. Ich hebe den Kopf und wittere wie ein Tier. 2 Panzer prügeln sich mit den riesigen Dreschflegeln durch den Matsch. Eine Mine detoniert. Der Lärm dröhnt in meinen Ohren. Gewehrfeuer kommt als prompte Antwort. »Fertig machen zum Vorrücken«, ruft unser Commander. »Los!« Geduckt renne ich über eine Obstplantage. Neben mir mein bester Freund im vollen Tempo. Gleich haben wir es geschafft. Gewehrkugeln zischen an mir vorbei. Mit einem großen Satz lande ich hinter dem Eisenbahnwall. 50 Meter näher am Ziel. Das trübe Novemberwetter erschwert mir die Sicht. Granaten schlagen ein. Schreie werden laut. Ich muss weghören, sonst drehe ich durch. Der Himmel glüht wie ein Kochtopf. Beschuss von allen Richtungen. Ein paar unserer Männer rücken vor. Boom, boom. Kugeln mähen sie nieder und bringen sie zu Fall. Es scheint absolut hoffnungslos. Die schicken Tigerpanzer. Entsetzt blicke ich auf. Das Quietschen der Ketten lässt mich zittern. Von hinten rollen sie aus dem Wald. Gleich werden sie schießen. Bereit machen zum Ausrücken, schreit unser Sergeant. Gruppe 1. Move to battle. Die Gruppe meines besten Freundes. Er blickt mich ein letztes Mal an. Das Gesicht kalkweiß. Dann ist er raus. Die Einschläge sind schneller als ein Sekundenzeiger. Gruppe 2. Move to battle. Ich erhebe mich. Das Gewehr schussbereit. Ich renne und renne und renne. Über mir die Kugeln. Auf einmal trete ich auf einen toten Körper. Rauchschwaden umrahmen ihn. Der Rücken ist blutdurchtränkt. Obwohl ich das Gesicht nicht sehen kann, weiß ich sofort, wer das ist. Ich möchte schreien, klagen, weinen. Gerade war er doch noch neben mir. Jetzt liegt er hier. Tot. Mein bester Freund. Der Tote ist Smitty. Weiter, weiter. Jemand verpasst meinen heftigen Stoß und katapultiert mich ins Hier und Jetzt. Wie ferngesteuert laufen meine Beine weiter. Ich bin allein. Mutter seelenallein. In der heutigen Folge spreche ich mit David Marshall. Ich habe ihn über einen amerikanischen Fotografen über Instagram kennengelernt. Damals war ich auf der Suche nach einem Amerikaner, der mir seine Sichtweise und seine Erfahrungen vom Zweiten Weltkrieg erzählt. Ich war gerade dabei, den dritten Band meiner Romantrilogie zu schreiben und wollte deswegen unbedingt mit einem amerikanischen Zeitzeugen sprechen. David wurde am 20. September 1924 in New York geboren. Zufälligerweise ist auch meine Figur Levi Sternlicht aus meiner Romanreihe 1924 geboren und meldet sich wie David freiwillig zur Army. Bei unserem Zoom-Meeting hat er seine Erlebnisse und seine Geschichte mit mir geteilt. In seinem Buch, das er mir geschickt hat, konnte ich genaue Daten nachlesen und habe auch ein militärisches Werk zur Schlacht um Gallenkirchen gelesen, bei der David selbst gekämpft hat. David gehörte dem 84. Infanterieregiment an und hat bei jener Schlacht um Gallenkirchen im November 1944 seinen besten Freund Smitty verloren. Anschließend kämpfte David im Winter in den Ardennen. Diese Kämpfe sind in Amerika unter dem Namen Battle of the Bulge bekannt. Diese Kämpfe waren sehr zermürbend und das Wetter war die reinste Katastrophe. Die Soldaten mussten bei etwa minus 20 Grad in Erdlöchern ausharren und in verschneiten und vereisten Wäldern kämpfen. Nach der Überquerung des Rheins hat Davids Einheit ein Konzentrationslager in der Nähe von Hannover befreit. Das Kriegsende selbst erlebte David an der Elbe. Die Szenen, die er dort erlebte, haben sich bis heute tief in sein Gedächtnis gebrannt. Was David mir noch alles erzählt hat, könnt ihr jetzt aus erster Hand in unserem Interview erfahren. Das nachfolgende Gespräch in dieser Folge ist auf Englisch. Okay, thanks for taking your time for the interview.
My pleasure, Raphael. I'm glad to help.
Yeah, could you give me a brief biography of yourself?
How far back do you want me to go?
Till your birthday, of course. And then a quick...
like, which birthday?
When you were born.
I was born in New York City in an area known as Harlem. And that was in New York City itself. We moved around a bit up to the Bronx, which is another part of New York, and then over to Manhattan, Washington Heights, which is a very nice area.
Which year were you born, David?
Pardon?
Which year have you been born?
Oh, 1924.
24.
Yeah. And Washington Heights was a nice place to grow up. It was a mixed neighborhood. We had a lot of different people there. And we got along well. And then the war came. And I wanted to enlist, but my mother wouldn't sign, wouldn't let my father sign. So I had to wait till 18. And then I was drafted. And when I was accepted, I called her from the draft board. And she made a comment, "You wanted to go." And I looked at the phone and I shook my head up and down. Yes, I wanted to go.
Which year was that?
Huh?
Which year was that?
That was 1943.
43, okay.
And I was 19.
So your mom was not happy about that?
Very much not happy. Up until then, well, what happened before, when I was 16, I was playing basketball in the schoolyard and I fell and I dislocated my left elbow, tore all the ligaments and the tendons, and I was strapped up in the hospital. And that was on December 7th, 1941, when the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor. It didn't affect me because I was 16. I said, well, it's not going to bother me. Little did I know. But anyway, after that, my arm got fixed, even though those in the hospital said it's going to stay at a right angle position like this, if you can see it. And my mother took me to all kinds of doctors to get proof that I can't go into the Army.
But so I had an arm. She wanted to keep you in the nest.
Yeah. Well, she wanted all my sister and my brother, too. I'll give you a for instance. What happened? My brother one day left a note. I got married and left home. Just like that. My sister was home. She was married three times. So my mother interfered so that she got divorced three times.
Did she marry your mom at the end?
She did not like her, really. But she did not ever leave home.
Yeah.
Which was a mistake. Anyway, I had a very rich aunt, my mother's half-sister. And she said, oh, no, we're not going to let this happen. I'll take you to my doctor. Her doctor was on Fifth Avenue in New York, was like Harley Street in London. All the experts, doctors, all the best ones were there. And he looked at me, he says, okay, let's get to work. He put my arm on his leg, boom, straightened it out just like that. And I had exercises and so on. And my arm came back and worked very nicely. And when she took me to the last doctor, he looked at me, he says, put your hand behind your back, which I did. And he looked at her and he said, she's going to be drafted, period. Very unhappy, but that's what happened.
Yeah, good for you.
So unhappy, I was drafted, and I was in the Army.
What happened traveled after that?
Well, I went to camp.
Yeah.
Induction camp, where they you take tests, IQ tests, get uniforms, they take your clothes, send them home. And then I was transferred to a medic camp down in Virginia.
But you passed the IQ test really well, I guess, right?
Yes, I did.
You told me yes.
I had a very nice score.
Yeah.
So Smitty's score was better than mine. I don't know what it was, but I'll swear it was better than mine. And I'll give you a for instance as to what the score meant. And this is a little braggadocio on my part. To go to OCS, Officer Candidate School, you have to have an IQ of 110. Not that high.
No, it's like average.
Yeah, so mine was 142.
That's very high.
And my best friend was 139, and Smitty, I know, was higher.
Crazy.
So went to this medic's camp to be a medic, a battlefield medic, which was not making me very happy. Then they had requests for people to either go to OCS, Officer Candidate School, or to go to ASTP, which was the Army Specialized Training Program, to train these soldiers, all of us that had good IQs, to be engineers. Because the feeling was, at the end of the war, we're going to have to build up the cities that we tore down. Yeah? So I thought about it. I said, look, they're now invading Africa, and they're going to Sicily, then Italy. If I go to OCS and graduate in 12 weeks, become a second lieutenant, I'm going to be put into a rifle company. And at 20 years old, I'm not going to lead men who've already been in combat. They're not going to listen to me. They'll probably shoot me in the back. So I said, I'll go to ASTP. And I went to this engineering school in Philadelphia. Very nice. We had a nice time. We lived in a hotel. And it was very interesting. Studied engineering. And at night, we went out of town, drank, met women, had a good time. All right?
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden, the Army closes it down because they needed warm bodies to fill the ranks of those that they lost in the invasions. And I went to the 84th Division Infantry and trained to be an infantry soldier. But I lucked out.
The rail splitters, right?
Yes, the rail splitters, which was named after Abraham Lincoln.
And which sign did they have?
An axe on a log.
Yeah, the red axe, right?
Yes. So I lucked out because I was put into a heavy weapons company. And that company had two platoons of machine gunners and one of mortars. And I got into the mortars, which was a little safer than the machine gunners. So I lucked out there. And we trained, and then we went overseas. Went to England for a month, did a little training, waited for the rest of the division to show up.
Did you take a ship back to England?
We took a ship to England. Each of the regiments came on a separate ship.
Okay.
We came first, and then we waited for the others to show up. We only stayed in England a month and then took a English transport across the channel to Omaha Beach.
Oh, crazy.
And then from there, we went up to the Netherlands. And we there again, we waited till the whole division gathered together and then went into combat in Germany. And that's the day Smitty got killed.
What time was it, David? What day?
The date was November 18th,
okay,
1944.
Can you tell us about the combat?
Well, that was a combat around Geilenkirchen. And we were fighting across a long, flat beet field, sugar beets.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in the ground. It was very tricky because you stepped on a beet, you could twist your ankle. So, and it wasn't too muddy, not like the book. The book is too muddy. It didn't rain that much, but the ground was soft. So that first day Smitty got killed, I walked over his body and I wanted to stay there. And I don't know, I couldn't have done anything, but I wanted to stay with him a bit. But I couldn't because the Germans were still shelling us.
Yeah.
And my company was moving further up ahead of me and I was last. So I had to start running to catch up to them. And the next thing I do, I came upon my sergeant, Sergeant Robert Prevett, who you have in the book.
Yeah.
Who was hit in both ankles.
And you couldn't walk?
No. He was lying there. A medic was working on one leg. And since I had been a medic before that, I stopped to take care of the other leg. We wanted to get him taken care of and out of there because the Germans were still shelling us. And then I went on further, caught up with my company. They dug in the mortar into a gun emplacement, and I started to dig a foxhole to protect myself. And the next day, we started the war again. We got out, we moved up further, we attacked Prümmern and captured Prümmern. And from there, we went on until December 16th, I think it was.
Could you tell us something about Smitty, David? Where did you meet him?
He was in my company, in my platoon, in the 84th, in Camp Claiborne, where I trained.
Yeah.
He was in the same platoon, so we became very friendly. We became friendly because we were two of the smarter ones. Really, that's the truth.
Yeah.
We came together. He lived in, actually, I live in Baldwin here on Long Island. He lived in the next town. I lived in the city then, but that's where he lived. He was a devout Catholic. I'm Jewish, but it didn't make any difference. We're both fighting, doing the same thing. And we were very friendly, very close. The night before we went into combat, we were in this Dutch farmyard right on the border of Germany. And we're talking. Actually, we went out just to talk and relieve the tension, relax a little if we could, because we knew what was coming. The next day was not going to be a good day. And he said to me, just like this, if anything happens to me, you've got to promise me to go visit my parents. And I looked at him, I said, there is no way would I do this. I can't do that. And we argued back and forth until I finally gave in just to keep him quiet. Because I did not have the feeling that anything could happen to either one of us. The next day we go into combat, and just like that, he's dead.
Unbelievable. Did you keep the promise?
Yes, I did. I had, after the war, I came home. It took 6 months before I had the nerve to call his parents, and they wanted to see me. So I took the train out from New York to Rockville Center to their house to see them. Now, this is, at this point, it's about 2 years after he was killed. So the initial grief period is over. They were very nice to me, very friendly, very considerate of my feelings. In fact, they called his girlfriend. She came over.
Crazy.
And it was not an easy meeting for me, but they made it as easy as possible. Very lovely people. And that was it. I kept my promise. And I have this little video. Did you ever see it?
Yes.
Called The Promise? Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I kept it.
And we both visited his grave in the Netherlands. It was a beautiful moment.
Yes. I've been there 3-4 times.
Yeah. But it was so happy there that you invited us to come.
Yeah. I went with my wife in 1974. We went there. And I went with my daughter and one of my grandkids.
Yeah.
We visited. And then lately, I mean, last 2 years ago, and then this year when you were there with us, that was a nice visit with all of us. to walk around, see the ground. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
For what it is, it's a beautiful place.
Yeah, definitely. With all the beautiful trees and the atmosphere, yes. Really special.
Yes. And the Dutch people are so nice taking care of those graves. They are wonderful people.
Yeah.
And that's the story as far as Smitty and myself and my, I won't call it devotion, but my feeling for him then and still now. Because when I go back next week, the end of the month, end of September, I'm going back to the cemetery.
Yeah, I can totally understand that.
Yeah. Any other question?
What happened after you, like, took Geilenkirchen?
We advanced further into Germany, past Geilenkirchen to Gerensweiler, Lindern, Linnick, going toward the Ruhr River. We never got to the Ruhr River because that's when the bulge started. And one late afternoon, we loaded up on trucks and drove down to Belgium. We didn't know where we were going, and we didn't know why we were going until we got there.
No one told you?
No one told us. I don't know who knew.
Okay.
Not too many people knew or said anything.
Hopefully the sergeant knew.
I don't know if the sergeant knew. What? I would think he should know. But kept quiet, never said a word. And we got there about 2 o'clock in the morning into Marsch, the town of Marsch, which was the last place the Germans got to, because we got there and we stopped them there. We didn't know where they were. We had patrols go out to find out where they were, and they were very close to us. And then we started a fight with them.
They came with a lot of tanks, right?
Loads of tanks. That they had one group of tanks whose only job was not to fight with us, but to keep moving to get to Antwerp and capture Antwerp. They figured they captured Antwerp, we'd be in trouble. They would sue for a separate peace, a negotiated peace, not unconditional. And that's what their plan was. It would have been a difficult time for us if they did. We eventually would have won. We had too much for them, but it would have been more difficult. But go ahead.
You told that the cold was the worst ever in the winter of 44 when you were sitting in the foxhole. Can you take us with you?
You don't want to go with me, but I'll tell you about it. When we first got there, it wasn't too bad. There was no snow.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how many days later it started to snow and it came down and the temperature dropped. We did not have any warm clothing because we left Germany too quick and they couldn't get anything to us. Some soldiers did have overcoats. We didn't have any. I had a jacket and a sweater. How we got through, I don't know. And it was hard to dig a foxhole because the ground started to freeze up. Initially, we could dig until it froze up. Then it was hard. And after Marsch, when we stopped the Germans and started to push them back a little bit, and we started to advance, we then walked around the north side of the bulge to cut them off. And eventually, we drove them back to Germany. I mean, it was a hard battle, but that snow...
How is it possible to fight when it's so cold? Does your weapons work?
Well, I'll tell you what we did. You had to keep checking your rifle if you had a rifle. Keep moving the breech back and forth to make sure it didn't freeze up. Some guys didn't do anything. They said, oh, no, nothing's going to happen. And it froze up on them. They got killed because they couldn't fire. They couldn't protect themselves. The only way we could get our weapons to work, if it did freeze up, was to urinate on them.
Yeah.
Because that's the only warm water we had.
Did you have enough food or drinks?
No.
No.
No, 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 no. No. And then I had a captain who insisted we shave in the snow. I said, you son of a bitch. You go to the mess, to the cook and get hot water, and you shave. But we have to melt snow to get water and then try to warm it up in our helmets, and we have to shave. I did occasionally, but I grew a mustache. Did you ever see my picture?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that shows you how cold it was.
Unbelievable.
And I still don't know how we got through. I keep telling people, well, I was so dumb and young and stupid, that's how I got through. But I was trained well, and I did all the right things. Wherever ever possible, I took my shoes off and my socks, rubbed my feet. I had warm socks under my armpits, put them on and put the others back under my armpits.
Otherwise you get some frostbites.
Yes. Yes. But you'll see that in the Balog Island, Kirkin.
Yeah.
It happened there, even though it wasn't that cold. But the weather was bad enough and wet enough.
How was it possible to dig the foxholes?
Where?
Did you use some grenades to, like, get in the ground?
We used dynamite.
Okay.
Small block of dynamite to loosen the surface. Then we could dig and get down. If we had time, we did. In some cases, we had to. Because the Germans would shell and have the shells burst in the trees. And you get a tree burst. Then all these shell fragments and the tree fragments, the splinters, would come shooting down. And if you're in an open foxhole or not in a foxhole, you could get hit very easily. So if possible, we would dig a foxhole, cover it over with some branches and dirt, and crawl in under the roof for protection. If you're a good soldier and you had training, you find ways to live.
Unbelievable.
And most of us found ways to live. And that's what it was, find a way to live.
Yeah. What happened after the Battle of the Bulge?
We went back up to Germany to the original positions that we had before.
Yeah.
We went to this town of Eigelshoven in Holland or the Netherlands. It was a coal mine and we had hot showers, fresh uniforms, and we all came out and said, oh, those hot showers, better than sex.
Yeah, I can't believe
it. I'm telling you, it was. For all the sex we did not have, this was better than sex. And then I met one of the best days. I was walking up the street after the shower, and I met my best friend in the world come walking down the street. He was assigned to the 102nd Infantry Division, which was alongside the 84th. You should see that in the book. And we looked at each other and couldn't believe that we'd met. And we had such a nice time for a few minutes to talk, and I couldn't stay, I had to leave. But we said, well, we're going to meet again. We have to. And we finally crossed the Ruhr River with difficulty, went across between the Ruhr and the Rhine. And that's where I got a Bronze Star medal, crossing that area.
How did you cross it? With little boats or with a big boat?
What, the Ruhr? We were supposed to cross the Ruhr River in boats.
Yeah.
But by the time we got to get to the boats, they were all shot up. And all of the boats were shut up, and we had fellows from my company dead in the boats already. So I had to go across a little further downriver and cross on a bridge that the other division put up. Cross the bridge and go back up to where we were supposed to land. Then we fought between the Ruhr and the Rhine. Got to the Rhine, and we sat there for about 3 weeks. But on the Rhine, Passover, the holiday Passover came. And we had Passover services on the Rhine River. Well, I never saw so many Jewish soldiers in my life. There were a load of them. And I looked and I found my friend. We found each other and we sat and we talked for hours at this Passover.
But you told me you got the H on your dog mark.
On my dog tags.
Dog tag, yeah, right.
Yeah, there's an H stamp for Hebrew.
Were you scared to have the H on it? Because when you got to get captured?
Well, yes. But a few Jewish soldiers in the company, we talked about it, had two options. Throw it away or transfer, get a dead soldier and take his. Either one eventually turned out to be a bad decision. If I threw it away, my parents would never know what happened to me.
Yeah.
All right. If I took somebody else's, that soldier's parents would know what happened to him, and I would be listed as him, and my parents would know what happened to me. So I said, nah, the hell with it. I'll take my chances. The other thing, if I threw it away, what difference did it make? I was circumcised. All right?
Yeah.
So that was it. So I kept him.
So what happened after you crossed the Rhine River?
Well, then the war got a little easier, because by that time the Germans were really defeated and they were running. We had a hard time catching them. They would put up resistance every now and again. No question, they were good soldiers fighting for their homeland. That'll give them. Because most of the Wehrmacht we found were not Nazis. It was the SS that were the devout Nazis, I'll say.
Yeah, it's a big difference, right, between the Wehrmacht soldiers and the SS.
Yes. So they would put up a resistance fighting for Germany. But when time came and they knew they couldn't win, they surrendered. The SS fought to the end. We captured some of them. They gave up. But it was difficult with them. And that's when we ran into the camp of Alam around Hanover.
The concentration camp, right?
Yes.
So your company was the one liberating that camp?
Yeah.
What did you experience this day?
Well, as we got closer, we could smell. What is that odor? And we sort of knew, because we ran across enough dead bodies in the field that were decomposing and smelled. But as we got closer, it got stronger until we got to the gates. And we couldn't believe our eyes, not for the smell, but for what we saw. Those lying on the ground, dying, those who were ill and couldn't get up, skinny as can be, some staggering around. We opened the gates and I said, some walked out free men when they knew we were Americans and died. They wanted us to feed them, but we couldn't feed them our food. If the food didn't kill us, it was certainly going to kill them.
Yeah.
They couldn't eat our food. Told them that the medics, nurses, doctors are behind us. We'll be following and give them warm milk, soup and milk and so on. And we had to go on chasing the Germans.
Were any people of the SS left in the camp?
No, there were no soldiers left. Nobody was there. They all took off as we were coming. They all ran.
And left all the prisoners behind.
Yeah.
How many prisoners do you think were in Alam?
Can't tell you. We didn't stay long enough to determine that. We knew we had to go keep chasing. And some people had stayed to make sure that the rear echelon nurses, medics, doctors got to the camp to take care. But being the frontline soldier,
yeah,
we had to keep running after them.
Can you still, when you close your eyes and remember the scene, can you still see the people there sometimes?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I can envision walking out and falling down. Three men. Like, it was hard to comprehend. But at least they walked out free, Eddie.
Yeah.
For all the good it did them, they walked out free. But the rest were taken care of. That could be taken care of. And then we chased the Germans to the Elbe River. We met the Russians.
Which town he was close to on the Elbe River?
Seehausen.
Seehausen.
Yeah.
What date was it? Like, was it 95 already?
Oh yeah,
sorry,
we came back from Belgium in January 1945.
Okay.
This was already almost May, late April, early May.
So almost like end of the war.
Right. What we found interesting, the Russians on one side, we're on this side.
Did you see the Russians already coming?
We saw them, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I hated their guts. These were fierce Siberian soldiers. They were terrible. Terrible enough so that the Elbe River, you couldn't see the river because it was covered with German soldiers crossing the river to surrender to us.
They were scared of the Russians and wanted to go to the Americans.
They didn't want to surrender to the Russians.
Yeah.
So they came to surrender to us. That gives you an indication as to what they thought of the Russians.
Yeah, the lady I was interviewing from Berlin, she said they were so scared when the Russians came because they had all the bad stories about them, about
yes,
women getting raped and stuff like this. And she was scared. She got raped. She was 10 or 11 and her mom.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And she was lucky because they had to cross. She was living around Berlin and they moved into Berlin. So they were lucky. They didn't have time to like stop too long.
It's always bothered me the fact that originally the Americans were supposed to go into Berlin, capture Berlin. But a deal was made with Stalin by Roosevelt, Churchill, Eisenhower to let the Russians go in. I'm convinced, no proof, I'm convinced that if the American army went into Berlin, they would not have resisted the way they did. They would have surrendered to us, given up, and I won't say nobody would have been raped. Because I had some American soldiers who had gone a long time without a woman, and I think some of them might have, but not what the Russians did. Give you a real ugly story that I saw a picture of it on the computer. As the Russians were advancing toward Berlin, they captured some area and they had this woman, and a bunch of them raped her. After they raped her, they took a bayonet and shoved it up into her stomach from her vagina.
Unbelievable.
I mean, how disgusting and cruel and unreal could this be? You raped her? Leave her alone. Enough is enough. But to do that as a final indignity, the mentality, my parents came from Russia, so I had no love for them ever. Never had any love for them. I did go to Russia after the war. Went to Moscow, St. Petersburg, and I didn't trust them one bit. There was another couple that was with us on the tour. He was a retired naval officer. And we were walking down the street in Moscow. He was in front of me. My wife and I were in bed. They came and arrested him. Nothing. Well, the guide who was with us finally got him out of prison, but no reason. Running around the hotel, you see these guys with earphones. These were all KGB. You could tell, sitting in the bar at the hotel with my wife having a drink, table over there with four or five men drinking. And I looked at them and I looked at her and I said, they just came back from Afghanistan. She said, how do you know? I said, I know. I looked at their eyes. They just came back from Afghanistan. They had a rough time, I'm sure. And as a soldier, I could have appreciated it, but I knew the way they were drinking, the way they were talking, the way they were looking, they were rough.
Yeah.
No, I never really trusted them, ever. Whenever I walked, I was, you know, always watching.
Yeah, my grandfather, the other one, who was not a medic, a doctor, he was a signaler, he fought the Battle of Berlin. And he said, like, they were, like, shooting 48 hours without a second break. And you were so scared, and you get shot when you didn't want to fight, so you had to fight until last second. And he got captured by the Russians, and he was able to flee from a working camp in Russia.
In Germany?
In Russia? Yeah, they took him to Russia, and he was
able... Do you know where in Russia they took him?
No.
Because many of them never got home.
Yeah.
And some of them, it took 5 years for them to get home.
All along.
But a lot of them never did. Hmm?
His friend, he was, I'm not sure what the English word is, when you do tables and chairs and stuff like this, like indoor stuff with wood. What's an English word?
Carpentry.
Oh, yeah, he was something like this. And he was so good. He was the number one work in the camp, and he like, shit, if I'm too good, they will never let me home. And he was in the camp for 7 or 10 years.
That long?
Yes.
Oh, God, he was lucky.
Yeah. So he got home in the 50s.
Oh, God. Even though he was a German soldier, I feel sorry for him. I really do. I mean, we can't... When I was training in Camp Claiborne, we had captured soldiers in camp from the Africa Corps, which were some of Germany's best soldiers, tall, blonde, blue-eyed. And they were in camp. We go out training in the field because that was not an easy place to train. Louisiana was not nice, not where they had the camp. And they would laugh at us. They had it nice and easy. A lot of them got out of camp. They worked on farms. A number of them married American girls. These guys had it good.
Yeah.
And we were still going to fight the war. But these were the best soldiers he had.
How did you experience the end of the war at the Elbe River on May 8th? Where have you been?
Well, We weren't fighting at that point. Our pod was quiet. This other fellow friend of mine went to visit this German woman farmhouse who had two daughters, and she brought out a bottle of whiskey when she heard the war was over, and we drank. I had appropriated a Volkswagen, Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah.
One of the first that they built, that the people were supposed to get never got, but I found it and I took it and I drove it. I was in the farmhouse, in the farmyard, and I left and I backed into the manure pile that the farmer had in the farmyard, and I couldn't get out. I had to wait till the farmer woke up, got a team of horses and pulled me out. That's how I spent the end of the war.
And after the war, you went to Paris or to France, right?
Eventually, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right after the war, or did you stay in Germany
no,
for a few weeks?
No. Went to a couple of cities in Germany. Hamelin, where the Pied Piper of Hamelin was written.
Yeah.
Karlsruhe.
Mm-hmm.
Karlsruhe was a very difficult town because we knew there were still SS people roaming around and we had to be careful. In fact, I went out with a gun every time I went out.
Oh, okay.
Most of us gave our guns up, but I had a captured Russian pistol in a shoulder holster, and I wouldn't go out without it. And then I went to France.
How did you experience the German people after the surrender?
For the most part, no problem.
Yeah.
No problem. There was one town in Germany that we stayed for a while. It was called Neckarsteinach.
Okay.
It was on the Neckar River, just north of Heidelberg,
mm-hmm.
about 9 miles north of Heidelberg. Very nice area. The town was, never saw any war at all. No bombed out buildings, no fighting, no nothing. Just as if before the war. And I had this German girlfriend, all right? I went to pick her up one day. They were living on a barge. I don't know why. But anyway, I went to pick her up. And her mother looks at me and says, you know, Hitler was right about the Jews. And I said to myself, oh, no, the war is over. Forget it. So I looked at her, and I'm wearing my pistol on my hip as a sidearm. And I started to pull it out of the holster. And she looked, and she turned every color of the rainbow. And in German, I told her I'm a Jew. Then she ran as fast as she could run. I put the gun back, took the girl, and we left. So it wasn't over. It was over, but it wasn't over.
Sometimes in the head's still like active.
Yes. It was over, but it wasn't over.
So did you meet someone from the Volkssturm?
From where?
The Volkssturm. The normal people fighting at the end of the war, who were not soldiers, but little boys or women or older people.
No. Oh, then I felt sorry for them.
Yeah.
Get shoved into a situation that they're going to come up against experienced soldiers.
When you're 12.
Yes, and you don't know how to fire a gun. And an older man could hardly pick up the gun. No, I felt sorry for them. But unfortunately, I did not meet them.
Yeah.
And that was the end of the war. I had a good time in Paris. Then I met my girlfriend in Lyon.
The beautiful girlfriend. French girl.
Well, you read the book, didn't you?
Yes, and I saw the picture.
And then you saw my mother, who loused the whole thing up for me.
Oh.
In fact, I won't go into the situation, but one night, I woke up and my sister said to me, who's Claudette? What do you mean who's? She says, you talk in your sleep. Be careful. I said, okay. My mother never knew. She never knew. She still doesn't know. Everybody else knew, but she didn't know.
That's too sad that she didn't know.
It was, but look, I had a good marriage.
Yeah.
For a lot of years, I mean, it's been 73 years now that I'm married to her, but before she went in, there was 70, 71 good years.
Yeah.
So I can't complain. It's just that I think what might have been. And then again, it might not have been that good if I married her. You never know.
Oh, David, did you experience a personal miracle during the war, your personal miracle when you say like, oh yeah, it's crazy that happened?
No, the only miracle I can think of is the fact that I was not wounded. I was hit a couple of times.
Yeah.
Once in the helmet and once in the foot. But it didn't penetrate and injure me. That's the only miracle I can really think of. The fact that I came through without a scratch.
You're living miracle now.
That's about it.
That you didn't get even a scratch. That's really special.
That's about it, yeah. Not a scratch.
What advice would you give to young people?
Which young people? the ones going into the army?
No, just young people, like going to school, kids, the next generation.
Well, when I go to school and talk to them,
yeah,
I talk mostly about the Battle of the Bulge and a little more. I say, whatever you do, make sure to do it right. If you're learning something, learn it properly and do the right thing. You do the right thing, very little is going to happen to you.
Yeah.
When you do the wrong thing, it's going to catch up to you. Now, I trained in camp, and I trained well. I listened to what they said, do this, even though what they told us to do, and many of us really griped and bitched about it, and they called it, pardon the expression, they called it chicken shit. All right?
Yeah.
That's chicken shit. That's chicken shit. But I did it, and I got through the war because of it. So that's my message to them. I said, I'm standing here 77 years later without a scratch in some of the worst battles of the war because I did the right thing.
Wow.
So if you're going to learn something, learn it right and do it right. I've had kids come up to me a year or two later to tell me about my talk and thank me for it.
Yeah.
So I know I was doing the right thing too. That's my miracle.
If you could describe the war in a few words, David, which words would you choose?
War is hell.
Okay.
And I didn't originate it. That was originated by General William Tecumseh Sherman in the Civil War. War is hell, no matter how you look at it.
Yeah. What do you think we can do to prevent something from happening again? Now we have the Nothing. War in Europe?
Nothing.
Nothing.
People are people and they're going to do things that cause a war.
Yeah.
Look, you have one man in Russia. Look at what he's doing.
And one You've man got, in Germany, like Hitler, and now we have Putin.
And then you have a couple of others in Hungary, that Hungarian dictator who just got reelected. I don't understand the Hungarian people. They should know better.
Yeah.
And then those in the Middle East. You know, I keep saying, bragging about it, when Trump was president, they had this thing in Charlottesville with these right-wingers marching, yeah. And they're yelling, the Jews will not supplant us, or the Jews will not replace us. And I looked at him and says, you friggin' idiot. The Egyptians couldn't do it. The Romans couldn't do it. The Byzantines couldn't do it. The Germans couldn't do it. You think you're going to do it? We're not going away. We're going to be here whether you like it or not. So get used to it.
Yeah. Get tolerant.
That's right. Look, we're all over the world. We're in Argentina, we're in South America, Mexico, even in the southwest of the United States. They practice Jewish rituals and they don't even know they're Jewish.
Yeah.
They are, but they don't know it. And they practice everything that's Jewish.
You should not judge a person by their religion or color, skin, or whatever.
No way. No way. And what I feel unhappy about all those that were killed in Germany. How many geniuses did you kill? How many brilliant people that could have helped the world? How many doctors? How many scientists did you kill that could have helped the world? I don't know. What they hate about the Jews is the Jews want to do better. They have to do better because they're being stepped on. The mantra, you got to go to school. You got to be educated to get out of to move up. I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to be a technical man. My mother insisted. It worked out okay. I didn't like it, but it worked out all right. She was right. Of all the Nobel Prize winners, 126 are Jewish. only because they persevere and they become educated and tolerant. Oh, I got some Jews who are not tolerant. I don't like them either.
They're crazy people in any kind of country or religion or whatever.
These are crazy. These are crazy. Anything else, Raffaello?
No, thanks a lot for sharing your story again, David. It's always a pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you.
You can learn so much.
If you listen.
Yes. Thinking about doing the right stuff and the right things in life.
Yeah, that's very important.
Yeah.
I go to the gym and I don't know half the people there, but everyone greets me every morning I go there. First of all, they're glad to see me walking alive and exercising. They keep saying, I got to be like you when I grow up. Yeah. I got to be like you. I got to be your age. I got to and do what you're doing.
Yeah.
So it's working out very nicely.
Yeah. And I think it's so important to listen to people who like your age and lived as a, or been a soldier to learn, look at you and to make it better in the future.
There's someone, when I go to the class, I say, look, I'm going to tell you right out, I'm 97 now. That was last year. The war is over for 77 years. So what you're looking at is history. I'm history standing in front of you.
Yeah.
And they go, and it dawns on them. A person who's alive is not history. History is dead. History's not dead. I'm standing there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you a few things. And most of them are appreciative. They come up afterwards, thank me, shake hands, and so on.
The future's in their hands. They have to fight for the freedom, democracy, and all those things.
Once in Washington, I was on they called it an honor flight. A bunch of us went to Washington. And as I was leaving, this young boy ran up to me. I was wearing a hat that said something. So he knew I was a soldier, infantry, and so on. He says, I'm going to go into the army. I want to join the infantry. What should I do? Pay attention to the trainer and do everything he tells you. Everything. And you'll be where I am now. You'll come through alive. That's what I told him. I can't tell him any more than that.
Yeah. So how was your feelings about going back to the Netherlands in May, where we met?
Oh, I loved it.
Yes.
Because I knew them. I knew them from when I went 4 years ago.
Yeah.
When we did the documentary, but that was a smaller trip with the photographer. It was very nice. Very nice documentary was made, which we showed last November. Had a big showing on it, and I met the people who take care of Smitty's grave. And others, and they're just lovely people. So I had a great time, and I love going back. And I'm going back again. I mean, as soon as I left, I told them I'm coming back. And they said, when? I said, I'll be back.
It's a little part of your home, maybe, the Netherlands.
Yes, yes.
Thanks so much for your time again, David. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Raffaella, anytime at all. Really a pleasure. I'm so happy to have met you.
Yes. History Wissen, die Ardennenoffensive. Diese dauerte vom 16. Dezember 1944 bis zum 31. Januar 1945. Die Ardennenoffensive, der deutsche Deckname dafür war Unternehmen Wacht am Rhein. Im englischen Sprachgebrauch ist er bekannt unter dem Namen Battle of the Bulge. Übersetzt heißt das die Schlacht der Ausbuchtung. Dies war ein Versuch der Wehrmacht, den westalliierten Armeen eine große Niederlage zuzufügen und den Hafen von Antwerpen zurückzuerobern. Antwerpen ist der einzige große Tiefwasserhafen und der größte Hafen Belgiens, über den die Alliierten Nachschub heranführen konnten. Von Antwerpen aus wollte Hitler dann die V2-Raketen auf London abfeuern. All das soll die Alliierten nach Hitlers Vorstellungen dermaßen demoralisieren, dass sie dann Friedensverhandlungen annehmen. Der Endsieg im Osten wäre dann wieder möglich. Das zumindest glaubt Hitler selbst. Oder möchte es glauben. Ohne den Hafen von Antwerpen hätten die Alliierten nicht die Nachschubmengen bekommen können, die sie für ihren weiteren Vormarsch gebraucht haben. Die Ardennenoffensive gilt als die vorletzte deutsche Offensive an der Westfront im Zweiten Weltkrieg. Hitler hoffte, die durch die Ardennenoffensive an anderen Frontabschnitten entstandene Ruhe ausnutzen zu können. Daher ordnete er auch in Lothringen und im Elsass eine Offensive, Unternehmen Nordwind, zur Zerschlagung der 7. US-Armee an. Beide Offensiven scheiterten letztendlich. Die Gegenoffensive sollte über die Ardennen erfolgen, einen dicht bewaldeten westlichen Ausläufer des rheinischen Schiefergebirges, eines Mittelgebirges, zu dem auch die Eifel und der Taunus gehören. Während sich der größte Teil des rheinischen Schiefergebirges in Deutschland befindet, liegen die Ardennen hauptsächlich in Belgien und zu kleinen Teilen in Luxemburg und in Frankreich. Da der Diktator jedes Vertrauen in die deutsche Militärführung verloren hat, plant er seine Offensive ganz allein mit nur wenigen Beratern. Das Oberkommando des Heeres wird ins Vertrauen gezogen. Einwände seiner Vertrauten, der Generäle Gerd von Rundstedt und Walter Model, wischt Hitler vom Tisch. Er verdrängt schlicht, dass die erfolgreiche Offensive von 1940 nur durch das Zusammenspiel von Panzern und Luftwaffe gelingen konnte. Mittlerweile beherrschen aber die Flugzeuge der Amerikaner und der Briten den Himmel. Ein weiteres Problem ist der Treibstoffmangel. Die deutschen Panzerverbände haben gerade einmal Vorrat für 60 Kilometer. Das reicht bei Weitem nicht bis Antwerpen aus. Hitler setzt deshalb darauf, dass sie unterwegs Treibstofflager der Amerikaner erobern. Außerdem ist er der Meinung, dass die Erfolge allein vom Willen und vom Durchhaltevermögen der Soldaten abhängen. Am frühen Morgen des 16. Dezember schlägt Hitler los. Um die Operation Wacht am Rhein selbst überwachen zu können, bezieht Hitler am Abend des 10. Dezember 1944 das Führerhauptquartier Adlerhorst im hessischen Ziegenberg in der Nähe von Bad Nauheim. Mehrfach wird der Beginn der Offensive verschoben, weil das Wetter ungeeignet ist. Allein ausschlaggebend ist das Wetter, spöttelt der Generaloberst Alfred Jodl im kleineren Kreis. Es wird daher vom Führer bestimmt. Hitler benötigt für die geplante Offensive eine dichte Wolkendecke, weil die Alliierten dann nicht fliegen können. Kurz vor Weihnachten ist es dann schließlich soweit. Es schneit wie verrückt. In der Eifel und in den Ardennen sinken die Temperaturen zeitweise auf minus 20 Grad. Am frühen Morgen des 16. Dezember schlägt Hitler los. Auf etwa 150 Kilometern von Monschau in der Eifel bis Echtenach in Luxemburg greifen die deutschen Streitkräfte bei dichtem Nebel an. Teilweise sind sie getarnt mit weißen Schneehemden. Am 16. Dezember vor Morgengrauen rücken 14 deutsche Infanteriedivisionen gegen nur 4 Divisionen der US-amerikanischen 8. Korps auf einer Frontlinie von 100 Kilometern an. Unterstützt von V1-Geschossen griff die deutsche Infanterie, dicht gefolgt von Panzerdivisionen, die alliierten Stellungen an. Den deutschen Truppen gelingt das scheinbar Unmögliche. Die Amerikaner sind völlig überrascht und überrumpelt. Sie haben mit allem gerechnet, aber nicht damit, dass die Deutschen, die den Krieg doch sowieso schon verloren haben, noch einmal einen Gegenangriff starten könnten. Die US-Truppen können ihre überdehnten Frontabschnitte nicht halten. Ein ungeordneter Rückzug unter teilweiser Zurücklassung von Waffen und Material setzt ein. Der Beginn der sogenannten Ausbuchtung. Die Lage der Deutschen ist so, dass die Großoffensiven nicht mehr einleiten können, hat der britische Oberkommandier Montgomery noch einen Tag zuvor behauptet. Den 200.000 Angreifern haben die Alliierten in dem Frontabschnitt nur etwa 80.000 Soldaten entgegenzusetzen. Ihre ungefähr 400 Panzer sind den 600 Deutschen unterlegen. Die Feuerkraft des amerikanischen Sherman-Panzers reicht nicht aus, um die Stahlpanzerung der neuartigen deutschen Tiger und der Panther zu durchschlagen. In der ersten Panik lassen die Amerikaner alles stehen und liegen und sie fliehen. Bald markieren hunderte zurückgelassener und ausgebrannter Fahrzeuge ihre Rückzugswege. Was die Amerikaner und Briten nicht wissen, viele deutsche Männer sind Kindersoldaten. Sie sind völlig unerfahren und kommen zudem auf den verschneiten Waldwegen nur langsam voran. Manche Fahrzeuge frieren am Boden fest. Es kommt zu regelrechten Panzerstaus. Dennoch kann Goebbels in der Nacht zum 17. Dezember festhalten: Der erste Erfolg unseres Offensivstoßes ist überraschend. Erstmals seit langem nehmen die Deutschen wieder in großer Zahl gegnerische Soldaten gefangen. Bei Malmedy werden am 17. Dezember mindestens 82 US-Soldaten, die sich ergeben hatten, von einer Kampfgruppe unter dem Befehl des SS-Standartenführers Joachim Peiper ermordet. Ein unglaubliches Kriegsverbrechen, für das Peiper nach dem Krieg verurteilt wird. Die Verwirrung bei Amerikanern und Briten ist sehr groß. Anfangs tippen sie noch auf ein Ablenkungsmanöver der Deutschen. Dass Hitler tatsächlich eine große Offensive begonnen hat, um Antwerpen zu erobern, können sie einfach nicht glauben. Dazu kommen Sabotageaktionen unter Führung des SS-Mannes Otto Skorzeny. Fließend englisch sprechende deutsche Soldaten In US-Uniformen schicken amerikanische Einheiten in die falsche Richtung oder zerschneiden Telefonkabel. Als sich das herumspricht, misstrauen sich die GIs in der Schneehölle der Ardennen gegenseitig. Es werden Kontrollfragen eingeführt wie: Wie heißt die Freundin von Mickey Mouse? Oder wer ist der neue Mann der Filmschauspielerin Betty Grable? Das kann allerdings auch nicht jeder Amerikaner aus dem Stegreif beantworten. Selbst an der Frage nach der Hauptstadt des US-Staates Illinois, was nicht Chicago, sondern Springfield ist, scheitern einige. Fast 2500 amerikanische Soldaten werden deshalb irrtümlicherweise als Deutsche verdächtigt und zumindest vorübergehend festgenommen. Darunter sogar ein General. Am 21. Dezember müssen sich 7500 Amerikaner ergeben. Es ist die größte Niederlage von US-Streitkräften im Zweiten Weltkrieg. Hitler ist bester Laune. Wie eine Riesenbeule ragt ihr Frontbogen in das alliierte Gebiet hinein, was der Schlacht ihren merkwürdigen englischen Namen geben wird: The Battle of the Bulge. Das ist durchaus ein Überraschungserfolg. Allerdings, Antwerpen ist von hier aus immer noch 140 Kilometer entfernt. Und mittlerweile haben sich die Amerikaner von ihrem Schock erholt und verlegen massiv zusätzliche Truppen ins Kampfgebiet. Manche tragen Schneetarnanzüge, andere hüllen sich in Bettlaken. Bald lösen sich Bewölkung und Nebel auf, sodass die Alliierten ihre Luftüberlegenheit ausspielen können. Als die Deutschen die Amerikaner zur Aufgabe der südbelgischen Stadt Bastogne auffordern, gibt General Anthony MacAuliffe eine Antwort, die berühmt werden wird: Nuts. Auf Deutsch sowas wie Quatsch. Ihr erinnert euch sicherlich an Ed Cottrell. Auch er flog mit seiner Maschine über Bastogne und war Teil des Luftkrieges. David selbst war mit seiner Truppe beim Marsch stationiert. Auch er hat im Interview von den Codewörtern erzählt. Jeder der Männer erinnert sich hauptsächlich an die bittere Kälte und den Hunger. An Heiligabend zeichnet sich schon ab, dass Hitlers letzte Offensive gescheitert sein muss. Der Überraschungseffekt verpufft, der Vormarsch stockt. Wir haben kein Otto und kein Hermann mehr, funken SS-Einheiten. Otto steht für Benzin, Hermann für Munition. Mitte Januar 1945 haben die Deutschen sämtliche Geländegewinne wieder eingebüßt. Wie gestrandete Schlachtschiffe bleiben ihre schweren Panzer in den Schneewäldern der Ardennen zurück. Die Verluste sind enorm. Mehr als 3000 belgische Zivilisten haben durch Artilleriefeuer, Luftangriffe und Häuserkämpfe ihr Leben verloren. Für die Amerikaner ist die Abwehr der Ardennenoffensive die blutigste Schlacht des ganzen Krieges. 75.000 bis 90.000 Mann werden getötet, verwundet oder gefangen genommen. Auf deutscher Seite betragen die Verluste nach Schätzungen zwischen 63.000 bis weit über 100.000 Mann. Dem Vormarsch der Roten Armee im Osten hat Deutschland jetzt kaum noch etwas entgegenzusetzen. Hitlers Kommentar dazu: Wir haben ausgesprochenes Pech gehabt. Am 15. Januar 1945 kehrt er nach Berlin zurück. Er wird die Hauptstadt nie mehr verlassen. Die schweren Verluste an Soldaten, Panzern, Kampfflugzeugen und Treibstoff beschleunigen den Untergang des Deutschen Reiches merklich. Nach dem Zusammenbruch der Offensive hatten die Deutschen ihre Fähigkeit zu raumgreifenden Unternehmen an der Westfront endgültig eingebüßt. Allerdings konnten die Westalliierten erst wieder Anfang Februar 1945 zum Angriff übergehen und erst Ende Februar wieder nennenswerte Geländegewinne verzeichnen. Nach dem Scheitern der Ardennenoffensive sagte ein Wehrmachtsoffizier sehr deutlich, dass man von der Festung Europa jetzt wieder zur Festung Deutschland übergeht. Insgesamt waren etwas über 1 Million Soldaten an der Schlacht beteiligt. Ich hatte das große Glück, David Ende Mai 2022 in den Niederlanden zu treffen. Er ist gemeinsam mit einer Gruppe Veteranen dorthin zurückgereist. Ich war bei der Zeremonie in Marsch, einem kleinen Dorf in der Nähe von Maastricht, dabei. Dieses Dorf war damals noch von den Deutschen besetzt und liegt an der belgischen Grenze. Dort wurde 1944 der allererste Amerikaner gesichtet, der über ein Feld Richtung Schule lief. Außerdem habe ich mit David zusammen den amerikanischen Soldatenfriedhof bei Margraten besucht. Dort liegt sein bester Freund Smitty begraben. Für David ist der Besuch immer ein schönes, aber auch ein sehr emotionales Erlebnis. Er stand lange allein vor dem Grab, hielt die Augen geschlossen. Ich konnte ihm ansehen, dass sein Gedanken an jeden Tag und Ort war, als er Smitty verloren hat. Er war lange im Gespräch mit ihm und hat anschließend auch an einem anderen Grab ein Gebet gesprochen. Dort liegt der Freund eines Bekannten begraben. Aus gesundheitlichen Gründen konnte Davids Freund die lange Reise nicht mehr antreten. Immer noch stehe ich in Kontakt mit David. Wir schreiben E-Mails oder Zoomen. Er ist ein Mann, von dem man so viel lernen kann. Seine positive Einstellung zum Leben reißt einen förmlich mit. Obwohl er im Krieg das Schlimmste gesehen hat, konnte er sich stets auf das Gute konzentrieren. Ich freue mich sehr darüber, dass ich David meinen Freund nennen kann. Ihm ist es sehr wichtig, dass seine Erinnerungen an diese Zeit lebendig bleiben. Auch möchte er, dass Smiddys Name nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Wenn auch du dir Davids Geschichte angehört hast, dann bist auch du einer dieser Zeitzeugen, die dazu beitragen, dass die Vergangenheit nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Wenn ihr ein Thema habt, das euch interessiert, dann schreibt mir sehr gerne. Vielleicht kennt auch ihr eine Zeitzeugin oder einen Zeitzeugen, der seine Geschichte gerne weitererzählen will, damit sie nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Meine E-Mail-Adresse sowie den Link zu meinem Facebook- und Instagram-Account findest du dafür in den Shownotes. Seid nächstes Mal auch wieder mit dabei, wenn es heißt Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg.